This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rupert Isaacson. He's author of the books The Horse Boy and The Long Ride Home. He will be at the Jean Cocteau Cinema here in Santa Fe tonight at 6:30, and the film that was made from his book called The Horse Boy will screen at 8:30, and he will be signing books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a delight to have you on. This is such an unusual and fascinating story. You discovered when your son was a small boy that he was autistic, and the options given to you by your doctors at that time were basically not any chance for cure or much therapy and a lot of money. What was this like, and what was your son like at that time?
Well, to any parent that gets that diagnosis, and particularly when it's given in such a negative way, obviously it feels like, you know, someone's hit you with a bat. And then they also say, well, we've hit you with this bat and we've broken your nose, but now your nose is going to stay broken for life. And that'll be $100 now and $100,000 for the first year of treatment, but it won't work. And it's really heartbreaking. My son was sort of floating away. He had been developing completely normally, and then around 18 months, he regressed very suddenly. So to watch, you know, any parent, your child, it's like watching your heart moving around outside your body. And to see that heart then floating away, it's devastating. So that's where we were at.
And what was your son's behavior like? I gather it was quite difficult.
Yes, what he would do is he would have these neurological firestorms. I mean, tantrums, meltdowns, but on a scale, on the sort of off the Richter scale, really. And that they could come from nowhere, even in the middle of the night in his sleep. And we subsequently found out that there were neurological reasons why this was going on. But at the time, we didn't understand at all. It was just completely bewildering.
So you had given up your great passion in life, which was riding horses, ironically, because at a certain point, your son made his way to, what was it, the neighbor's horse and sort of fell in love.
Exactly. For me, the most important thing in my life is horses, and I just thought my son wasn't safe around them, so I gave up. And for me, that was doubly sort of depressing. But yes, he did better outside. He just tantrumed less outside. We live in the country, so we spent all our time in the woods outside the house exploring and really sort of communicating kinetically through movement. And he went to my neighbor's mare. I happened to know that my neighbor's mare was a very quiet horse. So when he showed that he had this connection to her, I could follow it. And that, of course, is when everything turned around for us.
So what happened? What were those first moments like, and what happened after that?
He ran under her hooves and put himself on his back, and I thought he was going to get trampled initially. But she bent her head to him and began to lick and chew and half close the eye, which is this submission acceptance behavior that horses do, not unlike a dog showing its belly. And I hadn't seen a horse spontaneously offer this before, not even in sort of 30 years of training horses. When I first started riding with Rowan, he began to speak. And it was the same week that his speech therapist had given up on him. This was really extraordinary. And I literally began to spend all day, you know, 3 to 5 hours a day in the saddle with him. And I started painting letters on trees and counting footfalls of the horse and putting them together. And he became literate. He became numerate. And suddenly I had a therapy tool that was so much better than anything I'd been paying for and was really working. The other things had not been working, and suddenly we were away.
You then, at a certain point, got the idea of bringing healing through horses to a whole new level and to a whole new part of the world.
Yes. We ended up doing something rather extraordinary. We rode across Mongolia together, and going from traditional healer, shaman to shaman. And the reason we did that was because I'm a journalist, and I work in human rights in Africa, and I have been involved with hunting and gathering indigenous peoples for many, many, many years. And I had to bring a delegation to the United Nations the same year that my son was diagnosed and met Betsy the horse. And some of those guys met him, did some work on him, and got a great result. So it was logical for me to think, well, is there a part of the world that combines these two things that my son has had this great reaction to? So we rode across Mongolia, and even though, obviously, we went out with a child who was autistic and we came back with a child who was autistic, because there is no cure, and nor should there be, because it's a perfectly valid way to go through life with autism. But nonetheless, he left his three key dysfunctions behind him: his incontinence, his tantruming, and his inability to make friends. However, the healer there said that we had to make three more journeys. So we subsequently went through Africa and into the rainforests of northern Australia and onto the Navajo Reservation here in America to complete the healings over the following 3 years. And the new book, which is the follow-up to The Horse Boy, it's called The Long Ride Home, tells that story, and I will be reading from that book after the movie.
When you went through that initial healing, the first healing in Mongolia with the shaman there, he basically said, yeah, you have to do this three more times. Some problems will go away instantaneously. Other problems will go away in several years. Mm. How much of that actually played out?
All of it.
Wow.
It defies belief in some ways. When he said the stuff that really drives you crazy, the incontinence and the tantruming, you know, this will end sort of now, I really didn't know what to make of that, because I had been around a lot of shamans and healers in my life, because I also grew up partly in Africa. I probably saw my first healing like that when I was 7 years old on my grandfather's farm in Zimbabwe. So it wasn't anything new to me. And I wasn't used to healers saying things that were that unequivocal. You know what I mean? Normally there's a bit more vague.
Yeah.
But 27 hours after we rode down that mountain, Rowan did his first intentional poo and cleaned himself. And 2 weeks later, he was using the toilet. And it was like watching England win the World Cup, which will never happen. And so and we counted in the next 2 weeks that it took us to get back to our home in Texas from that mountain in Mongolia, six tantrums of any note. And they were pretty much gone by the time we got home. So it was extraordinary. And then, indeed, over the next 3 years, the following year, Rowan regressed and he began to slip back. This was right when we went to do the first follow-up healing in Africa. And then he sort of regained his ground. And this amazing mathematical dialogue began, which had not been there before. And then in Australia with the Aboriginal shamans there, what followed that was something called theory of mind, which was he began to play practical jokes on me, which is a very, very complex psychology. You need to know that other people think something different to you and they're not expecting what you're about to do. And typically with autism, that's just not there. And that kicked in immediately. And then finally, after the Navajo healing, we had speech at this point, but it was still very, very scripted. And anyone who knows anything about autism will know what I mean by that, sort of not really spontaneous back and forth conversation. And it completely kicked in the day we were driving out of the Navajo reservation. We had stopped at a McDonald's to get some breakfast, and Rowan wanted to have a horrible fruity flavored drink with lots of color dyes in it, which I didn't want to give him. And he got grumpy, and I got grumpy, and I accused him of being grumpy. And he, from the back seat, just said, "Dad, I'm not being grumpy. I'm just telling you what drink I want." And we were on I-40, my wife and I just pulled over onto the shoulder. I was like, who is this child? And it's sort of gone on from there. But what I do want to stress is that Rowan is still autistic. He's 14 now, but he's so functional within his autism. He runs his own web-based television show now, and he has an internship with a local road construction company that he loves, and they love him. And he will always be autistic, but what I learned through this whole thing is that autism is a completely valid way to go through life. If you get the right input, the right educational approach, the right environment, etc., there are so many adult autists who started life very severe. People like Dr. Temple Grandin, who's obviously very well known, who when she was three, she was rocking back and forth in a corner and wiping her poo on the walls, you know. And now, obviously, she's a best-selling author, a professor. She's revolutionized the livestock slaughter industry, etc. This is totally possible, but you need to approach the autism as a positive thing, not as a negative thing. You can't be trying to make autistic people not autistic. And unfortunately, many of the therapies try to do this. They try to sort of cancel out what they consider to be the inappropriate behavior and sort of coerce, make the kids comply with what are thought to be appropriate behaviors. And this sort of kills the kids' spirit. And it doesn't take a very long-term view. But what we've seen play out is that actually, if you dive into the autism and you embrace it and you make friends with it and you find out what gifts this child has and follow their interests and let them move and take all the neurological bad triggers out of their immediate environment, no fluorescent strip lights, you know, take out the industrial cleaning solvents, these things that can shut them down, then actually the possibilities are unlimited, and this is very exciting.
Diversity is a fact of biological evolution, and within a species, it's no accident that some of us are big and some are small and some are strong and some have other mental strengths and some are musicians and artists and some are very good at details and so on. What do you see from observing your son are the gifts of autism?
There are several really easily observable gifts of autism that you could say are to a large degree generalized across the autistic population. The three that spring most to mind, there's a very obvious one which everybody notices, which is their extraordinary memory, to the point that if not completely photographic in each individual, darn near, and the ability to rapidly calculate mathematical problems frequently kicks in at a certain age to a degree that's quite staggering. Then also there is this fact that they are not really distracted by social pressures, those rules of engagement and so on, which means that they can really get on with the job at hand because they can really concentrate, really be productive. If they're following something in which they're intrinsically motivated, they are more productive than you or I, they're less distractible. And there's often this goes often with an intellect that is operating at an extremely high level. But the third one, what I think is the principal gift, is one that's a little bit harder to define, and it's what Buddhists call the quiet ego. I, for example, I'm a neurotypical Homo sapiens sapiens male, which means I have an ego about the size of an 800-pound gorilla, and it's always getting me in trouble. And you know, my ego is there for a reason. It's there as a motivating force to try and make me, you know, achieve things in life and so on, and that's fine. But unfortunately, it also makes me suffer a lot. I'm always comparing myself to other people and usually finding that I come up short. You know, that guy's better looking than me, that guy's taller than me, that guy makes more money than me, that guy's, you know, better writer than me or whatever. And this is perfectly normal, unfortunately. So people like you, people like me, the neurotypicals, we do this all the time. We have this constant inner critic. And we suffer enormously as a result of it and make the people around us suffer because of it. There are lots of neurotypical people jumping off bridges every day because of this. One of the things about people on the autism spectrum frequently is they do not have this type of ego. And so it means that not only are they not suffering in that particular way, they don't make you suffer in that particular way. They don't press what brain people call your mirror neurons.
Right.
And because of that, you get a break, you, the neurotypical person, from your own ego and the suffering, the sort of intellectual, psychological angst that comes with that. So the question becomes, who's the therapist? Should we be paying autistic people $100 an hour to hang out with? Because we get a break from our own psychological dysfunction? Quite possibly. When you go into indigenous situations, like in Mongolia, like with the Bushmen in the Aboriginal settings and so on that we've been in, you often find that the person who is the healer or the shaman in that society suffers from neurological symptoms, neurocognitive symptoms, often to the extent that they would be institutionalized in our culture. So could be adult autism, schizophrenia, bipolar, epilepsy, etc. And there, this is very interesting, it's regarded as a job qualification. Yeah. And these people are not woo-woo. They don't know what the word New Age means. They are all about survival. They are the most practical people on the planet. They do not have time to waste with things that don't work. Things either work or they don't. But what they do have is, or have had, is, you know, eons in the same environments working out what works for them. And this is how they operate. And, of course, if there was nothing in it, if it was all rubbish, they'd all be dead. Because many of them live so far away from any kind of Western medicine. They're practical people, so they will use Western medicine when it's available, but it frequently just isn't. So what do they do in the meantime? And almost always, these people are the healers. So they are targeted. People like my son would be targeted for formal training beginning in adolescence. In our culture, we marginalize these people. But everybody who works with autism gets addicted to it, partly because it's very, very, very healing to be around these sort of born bodhisattva Buddhist people who just sort of heal you through their presence. So forget their memories, forget their amazing intellect, forget their amazing ability to get on with a job that interests them. This alone is of enormous value in our suffering society, because we all suffer. So those are just some of the gifts.
Rupert Isaacson is author of the books The Horse Boy and The Long Ride Home. He will be at the Jean Cocteau Cinema tonight at 6:30, and at 8:30, a screening of The Horse Boy, which is a documentary based on his first book, will take place, and Rupert will be there to sign books. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.